Good morning. On today's programme, wildfires and melting glaciers on Mount Kilimanjaro and a makeover on one of the world's most famous coastal promenades. But first we go to Iran, which is entering its third month of protests since the death of Mahsa Amini, the young Kurdish woman who died in police custody after being arrested by morality police. Faced with global condemnation, the regime has pointed the finger of blame abroad, accusing foreign media of deliberately fomenting dissent in the country. And as Lorraine Malander reports, despite lacking credibility itself, the regime is quick to seize on opportunities to discredit reporting and establish narratives that can justify a harsher crackdown.
Reading Ayatollah Khamenei's tweets this week, all is well in Iran. The wave of protests that hit the country in September might be far from over, but the country's scientists have been busy building the world's largest telescope, creating a new hypersonic missile, and finding a cure for blood cancer. For the increasingly embattled regime, in place since the 1979 revolution, control of the narrative is everything, even if its version of events, as with this week's claims, don't quite stand up. In the regime's view, protests over the death in custody of Mahsa Amini, a young Kurdish woman arrested for wearing her hijab in a way that displeased morality police, are all down to a multi-pronged foreign plot. Foreign media operations are integral to this supposed plot. Outlets like London-based BBC Persian and Iran International accused of spreading propaganda to stir up trouble and bring down the regime. One thing's for sure, though. With the regime's draconian censorship of internal media, which has seen more than 65 journalists jailed since protests began, Iranians have become dependent on these foreign outlets for information. Where else can they read about the killings, arrests, beatings and forced confessions that have been happening for over 2 months now? On the Iran-Iraq border, World Report interviewed a number of Iranians who gave first-hand accounts of what they'd seen, confirming reports of brutality from security forces. Yes, the regime will end, but there will be a lot of blood, said a bus driver from the city of Piranshahr in the country's Kurdish region. The day before, there'd been an alleged terrorist attack on a Shia shrine in Shiraz, in which gunmen killed 15 people. The attack had quickly been claimed by Islamic State, but everyone we spoke to rejected that narrative, indignant that the government had then accused protesters, or rioters as it called them, of paving the way for terror. They said it was Daesh, said the driver, using the local term for Islamic State, with a slightly forced, cynical laugh. I thought Daesh were over in Iran. Victory over the terror group had indeed been declared in the country back in 2017, though there had since been an attack in the southwestern city of Avaz in 2018. You can compare this government to Daesh, he continued. They do what they want to do in the name of religion. The international community needs to put them on a terrorist list. A few days later, Islamic State released a video of the attacker pledging allegiance to the group's leader, which caused some doubters to backtrack. But whatever the truth in this murky affair, reactions demonstrated that the government lacks credibility within its own borders. The absence of credibility is because there's no transparent investigative system there, says Shaheen Milani, executive director of the US-based Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. Right now, there's simply no way of finding out the truth. Narratives clashed again in mid-November after attacks on the city of Isfahan and Izeh. The attack in Izeh, in which two gunmen opened fire in a market, killing 7 people, including 2 boys aged 9 and 14, was again blamed on terrorists. But this time the scrutiny came thick and fast. Radio Farda, a US-funded Persian station, cited video footage showing a relative of the 9-year-old saying he'd been shot by security forces while riding in his father's car. Iranian state broadcaster IRNA had already published a statement in which Islamic State claimed responsibility, but this was swiftly taken down after sceptics, including the terror group's own militants, cast doubt on its authenticity. Still, Iran upped the ante, its foreign minister accusing external enemies, in particular Israel and the West, of plotting a civil war. As the rhetoric gets more heated, foreign media outlets with little access to the country need to tread carefully. Recently, Newsweek reported that 15,000 detained protesters faced the death penalty, a claim that proved to be wrong. It all stemmed from a parliamentary statement calling for decisive action, which had been translated as a demand for executions. The fake news spread round the net like wildfire, with the likes of Canadian PM Justin Trudeau tweeting it to his 6 million followers. To date, 6 protesters have been sentenced to death and 21 protesters are facing charges carrying the death penalty. But make no mistake, says Milani, the heart of the matter is not up for debate. A lot of people are being killed, arrested and tortured, he says. The space between truth and fiction benefits the regime, he says. It creates uncertainty and confusion. The regime's opponents get distracted, their time spent arguing over what happened. If news turns out to be false, then the government uses that to say everything the media say is false, even if its own narrative completely lacks credibility. At the time of reporting, over 400 people had been killed by security forces, according to Norway-based group Iran Human Rights. That number could rapidly go up if this battle, fought in the infosphere as well as on the ground, escalates further. For World Report, this is Lorraine Malander.
To Tanzania next, where Africa's last remaining glaciers are set to disappear by 2050. Studies carried out by the UN on 50 World Heritage Sites have revealed that glaciers at a third of the sites are retreating at an accelerated rate. The melting ice caps are responsible for nearly 5% of sea level rise, according to the agency. Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania is one of the mountains on track to lose its key features. Amy Nierida visited the mountain and sent this report.
As the highest mountain in Africa, Mount Kilimanjaro is one of the top climbing destinations in the world. Over 30,000 people climb the mountain each year, and it's Tanzania's biggest tourist attraction. However, the increased frequency in the number of wildfires on the mountain has become a major cause for concern for residents, conservationists and business people. To make matters worse, the UNESCO World Heritage Site looks set to lose its glaciers, some of the last remaining in Africa, by 2050. The revelation could be devastating for the tourism industry, but even more concerning, a stark sign of climate change. I'm told by a conservationist and resident on the mountain that recent rainstorms there were the first in 2 months, helping to extinguish the wildfires which started at the end of October. Claudia Hemp has been living 1,400 metres above sea level on Mount Kilimanjaro for 32 years. And since moving from Germany, the population has increased in Tanzania by 43 million. The rise in human activity combined with an increasingly dry climate has resulted in more frequent fires and melting ice caps. Travelling back down the southern slopes of Kilimanjaro from Claudia's house, I noticed the greenery fading and the dust from the dry ground rising to meet me. The mountain has its own microclimate due to its vast size and freestanding nature. Climbers experience 5 distinct climate zones on their way to the summit. That microclimate is changing. It's not getting hotter, but drier. The lack of precipitation has contributed to the size of the glaciers shrinking by 80% in 110 years. For local residents, the reduction has been quite obvious. Mauli Bwaba has been living in Moshi, the town on the foothills of the mountain, since 2008. He says his favourite thing about living in the town is opening his curtains to the view of the glaciers every morning. But that view is not what it used to be. The ice, he says, has greatly thinned and barely covers the top of the mountain now. He's devastated by UNESCO's report showing that they'll be completely gone by 2050. Mauli also knows that living by the fires is a risk, but it's worth it, just for the snow-capped views. Another concern for those living on and around Mount Kilimanjaro is what these extreme natural events are doing to the tourism industry, on which the town of Moshi is heavily reliant. Hundreds of vendors line the streets trying to tempt passers-by with their handmade African produce, from paintings to jewellery. The loss of that custom this particular week is apparent. On my sunrise arrival into Kilimanjaro, prime time for safari tours, the Air Tanzania flight was half empty. That meant that stall operators were forced to charge a little more than a usual weekend as they tried to make up for the loss in footfall. Of course, there's the arguably more pressing matter of the fate of the wildlife living in bushland prone to wildfires, as well as that living higher up the mountain, which is part of the Amboseli National Park. While melting glaciers are causing the formation of some lakes, the lack of rainfall means that streams and rivers originating from the mountain have either dried up completely or have lower volumes of water. Conservationists are warning that rapid climate change coupled with loss of habitat and other ecological stressors eventually could lead to the disappearance of some species altogether. Mount Kilimanjaro supports the world's best known, most studied population of African elephants and endangered species including cheetahs and wild dogs, and contains a system of wetlands welling up from the mountain. Recognised throughout the world as a symbol of Africa's wild beauty and majesty, Mount Kilimanjaro could soon serve as the world's most visual symbol for climate change. For World Report, this is Amy Nirida on Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
Finally, we go to Cannes in the south of France, where a makeover of one of the world's most beautiful coastal promenades is due to get underway shortly. The Boulevard de la Croisette hasn't been modernised in 60 years, but the legendary route in the festival city is about to undergo a major transformation, as Connor Power reports now from Cannes.
On a typically warm and sunny late autumn day in Cannes on the French Riviera, a crowd has gathered at the large Palais des Festivals. Cannes' finest are out in force. The local town hall and its large number of employees, as well as representatives from the tourism sector, journalists, photographers and onlookers, are all here to witness the unveiling of the winning design for the reinvention of Cannes' famous Boulevard de la Croisette. Curiously enough, the origins of the name Croisette go back to the Provençal language word Cruzetto, meaning little cross, because centuries before this place became a palm-lined dual carriageway between beach and palace hotels, it was a sandless shoreline and point of embarkation for pilgrims visiting the monastery of Sainte Marguerite, one of the two Lérance islands, located just offshore and where our own Saint Patrick was once a student. It was British aristocrats in the mid-19th century who then turned this once marshy piece of coastal ground to the east of the original fishing village of Cannes into a fashionable resort. Since the 1950s, it has been the venue for the annual Cannes Film Festival, the largest and most prestigious in the world, with the Palme d'Or being the prize that every serious filmmaker would consider the ultimate one. Now it has been decided that the time has come for the 3-kilometre-long Boulevard de la Croisette to get a revamp. In April 2021, Cannes Mayor David Lisnard, a man of Cannes fishing family stock, launched a competition for architects to submit the winning design, and today is the day that the chosen one is revealed. Strolling along the Boulevard de la Croisette, the only thing I could possibly complain about is the traffic. Apart from that, it's a beautiful stretch of roadway and promenade, running along the graceful curve of the Bay of Cannes, with magnificent tall palm trees, discreet fancy shops, and beautiful palace hotels. Here, people stroll and pose with an energy bordering on the aggressive. So why change this beautiful boulevard, and why now? I put the question to Christophe Biche, the man in charge of urban amenities and public facilities at the Mairie de Cannes, or Cannes Town Hall. We're now in the 21st century and 60 years on since the last time the Croisette was remodelled, says Mr. Biche, and the world has changed a lot since then. Most notably, he says, is the issue of climate change, and that was one of the main principles at stake in deciding how the new Croisette would look. The winning design came from the Norwegian-based Snøhetta Architectural Agency, whose submission was made jointly with the Paris-based Atelier d'Urbanité Roland Castro. Snøhetta has been responsible for a number of stunning designs around the world in recent years, most notably the Library of Alexandria in Egypt, the extraordinary Oslo Opera House, and the headquarters of Le Monde newspaper in Paris. The new Le Croisette will begin to take shape in 2023, beginning with underground works, but there isn't a finishing date yet for this massive makeover that will remodel one of the most famous stretches of coastal road and promenade in the world. Looking at the designs projecting on the big screens at the Palais des Festivals, it will feature a lot of sleek lines and the use of red granite. Redolent of the old Le Sucre district, the Cannes Film Festival red carpet, and the red of the Estoril Mountains nearby, which are visible from many points along the Croisette. Custom-designed furniture will complement the brickwork that will snake around the semicircular bay, calling to mind the backbone of a long sea mammal. Benches with a long curved design will be positioned along the boulevard, while canopies will provide shade and more of the Art Deco accent associated very much with the Croisette. There will be more room for pedestrians. The beach has already been doubled in width for most of its length, with specially quarried sand imported to fill the larger strand. A Thalasso thermal system will be created, and the space for the La Malmaison Art Centre will be tripled. This is big budget stuff. Although most people are familiar with Cannes as home to the world's largest film festival, it accommodates a whole host of festivals and promotional events throughout the year, from yacht shows to advertising awards. The private sector, and that includes a number of very large and prestigious five-star hotels, as well as numerous top-end jewellery shops, have already invested €1 billion in the Croisette, a figure that Christophe Biche says will be matched by public funding for this entrancing transformation over the next few years. For RTE World Report in Cannes, southern France, this is Connor Power.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.